And stay tuned for the Surreal News, which is coming up next on WSLR 96.5, Low Power FM in Sarasota, Florida, your community station. Stay tuned for a great edition of the Surreal News, which is coming up next. Alright, thanks for tuning in and welcome to the Surreal News on WSLR. My co-host is Andrea. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, Steve.
Alright, what's up today?
Well, we have a busy show this morning. In just a few minutes, we have a Dan Signorelli calling in. He's a lawyer and founder of Vivisana LLC, which is an organic sunscreen and skincare company, and he's going to talk to us about some of the breaking news on the FDA clarifying rules on sunscreen ratings. Then we have
That's kind of weather-related.
It is weather-related. We're getting ready for the summer, and it's going to come on big time, because next we're going to talk to Paul Flaherty from NOAA, who's going to tell us about hurricanes. And as I understand, he goes inside and flies around on the inside of hurricanes.
We're going to take the WSLR plane up inside a hurricane today. Fasten your seatbelts and hold on. We're going inside a hurricane. We're going to learn all about NOAA hurricane predictions.
Wow, interesting. And to bring us back down to reality, what happens after a hurricane? We're going to talk to Ed McRain, who is the Director of Emergency Management for Sarasota, and he's going to tell us how to get ready for hurricanes and what to do after they come.
And you know, we have a new Tannen Weekly. Pete Tannen has been on vacation. He's back.
Oh,
and we
good.
Have a new great Tannen Weekly, which is fabulous. And then we have our Media Matters Minutes, too. We have some news items. We're not going to have a lot of time for news at the beginning of the show, but we'll try to get to some news items later, starting with this news item, Andrea.
Yes. Let's talk about IKEA, because we have one here in Tampa. IKEA's had a reputation for fair dealing and good labor practices, and being Scandinavian, being a better corporate citizen overall than many American companies. Last week, we learned that IKEA stores are designed to intentionally confuse us and trick us into buying more stuff. That means that they set up an exit strategy that really doesn't allow you to exit till you've walked through the whole store, and I've certainly experienced that.
Absolutely.
In IKEA stores. It's pretty wild to try to get out of one of those places.
Hey, I didn't know we needed that. Let's buy that.
Yeah, really, it's like a maze. But besides that exit strategy business that they're pulling, which many American companies and stores do too, now, according to the Los Angeles Times, IKEA's U.S. factories are behaving very unswedish, and to the dismay of workers, they're acting very American. The Times reports of the Danville, Virginia plant that workers complain of eliminated raises, frenzied work pace, mandatory overtime, along with claims of racial discrimination. Efforts to organize a union there, which have been going on for about 3 years, are also being met with high-paid legal opposition, according to the Times. None of this is especially new in America, but it's shocking in Sweden, where IKEA is considered a national corporate treasure. Most workers are happily unionized, and things are considerably better. The Times compared IKEA workers here with their counterparts across the pond in Sweden, where they make $19 an hour and they have 5 weeks of paid vacation. Full-time employees here in the U.S. start at $8 an hour with 12 vacation days, 8 of them on dates determined by the company. Is America becoming a cheap source of labor for European companies? That's a good question. This is what we must feel like to be Mexico post-NAFTA. Well, on the upside, it's going to put more pressure on labor practices, and hopefully we can pull IKEA, you know, back to its.
Yes, interesting. I shopped IKEA recently, and sure enough, couldn't find an exit. Very interesting story about unions. It seems unions in the news. All right, let's change gears, and we're going to talk about sunscreens next. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, how are sorry.
My co-host is Andrea. You're on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and she's going to introduce you.
Yes, hi. We're speaking to Dan Signorelli, who is a lawyer and a founder of Vivi Sana Skin Products, LLC. And this company, as I understand it, produces organic skin products. But today, Dan, what we want to talk about is the FDA clarifying rules on sunscreen ratings, which seem to have really gotten out of control in the last 10 years and seem to be a huge money-making proposition for these companies.
Well, that's right. I mean, the FDA, the last official rules were approved almost 30 years ago, actually over 30 years ago in 1978. And since then, there have been lots and lots of proposed rules to clarify labeling so consumers would have a better idea of what they're getting. But, you know, there's been a lot of lobbying, and for a variety of reasons, rules have never been passed. So this is something people have been clamoring for some time. It's overwhelming for a consumer to see all sorts of claims which are vague or misleading or incomplete, and really try and figure out what's best for their skin and for protecting their skin.
Yeah, well, you know, two things that stand out to me in this, you know, new rating system that they're trying to clarify is, as I understand it, anything less than 15 doesn't do any good, but anything over an SPF of 50 is also just throwing money away. It's useless.
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, I guess there are three main changes they made, and one of them was, you're right, it was pointing to the number 15 and saying, if your SPF is below 15, you can't make a claim that the sunscreen helps prevent skin cancer or helps prevent skin aging. If you're over 15, you can only make that claim if you also, if you protect against both UVB, ultraviolet B, and UVA rays. Currently, SPF only refers to UVB, so that's a big change. They're now looking at UVA as well. So in order to make those sorts of claims, it has to be at least 15. The over 50 rule actually wasn't passed. That's something they've proposed. And the theory there is there's limited evidence that anything over 50 really does much, sort of a declining amount of protection you get, diminishing returns after 50 or even after 30. That was the original proposal. That wasn't passed. So right now that's not the rule, but the rule was going to be, or maybe in the future, that sunscreen companies can no longer say SPF 65. They can only, if it's over 50, they can just say 50 plus.
I see.
Because, and the reason behind that is the FDA is concerned that consumers will say, oh, I have an SPF of 100, I can't possibly be burned, but in fact, it really doesn't make much difference if you're 50 or 100. So it gives people too much confidence in their sunscreen.
And there's a difference between being burned and getting cancer.
Well, that's right, too. And again, that goes to the UVA issue. UVB light is what burns you. And so SPF refers only to that, and it basically gives you added protection against burning. UVA rays are not as strong as UVB rays, but they're much better at penetrating to deeper skin layers, and they cause aging. They degrade the elastin and collagen at deeper layers in your skin, and they can also cause cancer. And it's actually a particular issue for people who don't burn easily and think that they're fine, because a lot of damage can be done even when you're not burning. So, you know, that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Interesting. And I guess what happens to consumers is if you think it's a really high-performing, you know, SPF, you don't put it on frequently. You just think, well, I've got this really strong, powerful, you know, thing on, and it doesn't need to be reapplied.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that the FDA is really trying to prevent skincare companies or sun care companies from giving that sort of false sense of confidence, because another thing they said is, you know, you can't say your sunscreen is waterproof or sweatproof anymore, because that's an absolute term. It's not true. Clearly, it's not, you know, it's not waterproof for 100 years or for 10 years or for all day. It might be for 40 minutes or 80 minutes or whatever. And so the new rule is they can no longer say sweatproof or waterproof. They can only say water-resistant or very water-resistant. And then they also have to specify what sort of clinical test was done, and the two numbers are either 40 minutes in agitated water or 80 minutes in agitated water. And so that tells the consumer, okay, well, if I go for a 40-minute swim, by the time I'm done, it's pretty much going to be off and I have to reapply. When it said waterproof, people didn't think that. So,
all right, so my wife looked at our sunscreen. She saw that it was B. It didn't address the A in some 15s and 30s, et cetera. She's talking about throwing that stuff out and starting over because she doesn't want to get cancer. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that it's another thing to keep in mind here is that these new rules don't go into effect for another year. So right now, sunscreen companies can continue to not give you kind of the full information or misleading information. One thing to do is you can look at the ingredients, and there's a lot of chemicals, so it's not easy to kind of keep straight what is safe and what isn't. But zinc oxide and titanium dioxide are the only non-synthetic derivatives that you can claim as a sunscreen active.
So which are safe.
Yeah, and they're much safer, especially zinc gives full broad-spectrum protection. It's the best against both. It's a physical block. Not to get too technical, but the sunscreen, synthetic sunscreen actives don't block the rays. Technically, they scatter and absorb them and do all sorts of strange things, and there's concerns that can actually cause skin cancer or have other deleterious effects. So the safest and easiest way to go is to look for zinc and titanium. You know, the drawback is sometimes they can leave your skin a little bit white. You know, it doesn't always rub in as well, but there are definitely products out there that do a good job.
Right. Well, Dan, listen, thank you very much for this little overview on sunscreen, and it's been informative, and hopefully we can get all of this confusion cleared up. The other thing is if you've got sunscreen that's been sitting around for more than a year, throw it away because it's no longer useful, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that again, it depends, but yes, I think certainly if you see any kind of separation or discoloration or the smell doesn't seem right, throw it away immediately.
Okay, we have to cut this short now because we have to move on. We've got another guest, but thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You too.
That was very helpful. Yeah, some of that sunscreen with all those chemicals and stuff, the zinc sounds like the way to go there with the broad spectrum.
Absolutely.
All right, we have a Tannin Weekly.
Oh,
we've been
boy.
Waiting. It's been a couple of weeks. All right, so let's get to that, and then we have our next guest coming in after that. Oh, maybe not happening here. Let's see if we can get this going. Well, it looks like our Tannin Weekly is not going to be playing right this way. Why don't you just do a short news item, and let's see if I can get the Tannin Weekly a different way here.
Okay. Well, let's talk about another health issue in the States, obesity. Though we're supposedly the greatest nation in the world, one place America definitely isn't the best is life expectancy, according to a new report from the Institutes of Health Metrics and Evaluation. While even our next-door neighbors in Canada are living longer, the new study, which uses information from between 2000 and 2007, says more than 80% of American counties fell in standing against the average of the 10 nations with the best life expectancies in the world. Things are especially bad for women and blacks. Both groups have seen their life expectancies shift dramatically downward relative to other countries. There are now 5 counties in Mississippi in which women are expected to live less than 74.5 years, which puts them behind women in Honduras and El Salvador. For context, the Honduran GDP, $14 billion, is less than 1% of the American GDP, $14 trillion. Black men have a lower life expectancies than white women, and men in every American country, with some black men expected to live just 59.4 years. That is shorter than even Brazil and Latvia. Though some might be tempted to ascribe these problems to diversity or Americans' population boom, researchers say they are dying early for the same reason that they've always been dying early: obesity, tobacco use, and other preventable risk factors. We ought to all go out and take a walk.
All right. Well, let's go to some non-preventable risk factors, and that is hurricanes. And I have on the line, returning here to our show, Paul Flaherty. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
And welcome. This is WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. This is our local community station, Surreal News. And Paul is the chief of the science section of NOAA. Let's see if I can say it this right this time. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Did I get it right that time?
Oceanic, but you were otherwise perfect.
That's not what always gets me. He's the Aircraft Operations Center. He's at the Aircraft Operations Center, MacDill Air Force Base. So there's a number of things I wanted to talk to you about, but one of the things that came up in the late-breaking news was about hurricane predictions and some news about they're modifying or changing the way they're doing predictions. Is that correct?
Well, there are some changes, which is actually a good thing. I mean, it's anytime you can find good news when it comes to getting people out of the way for hurricanes, that's always something we want to promote. And we've been, our forecasters, I should say, over at the National Hurricane Center have been doing such a good job with the forecast that they are extending the watches and warnings, I believe, by about 12 hours than we have in the past. And a big portion of why that is because of what we're doing here at the Aircraft Observation Center, Aircraft Operations Center. With the data that we're collecting, that's where everything starts from there. But this year, there's going to be some very big improvements on how that data is assimilated and also the amount of data that we're able to send off the aircraft. So good things amongst the bad news of having to worry about hurricanes.
All right, so that's kind of some technical stuff. Can you give us, I'm kind of a geeky guy, can you give us a little bit of insight into any of the new breakthroughs that you've come across?
Yeah, we have a lot of new things coming online this year, which is, again, is a good thing. Part of it is of a longer program that we have called HFIP, which is the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Plan. And a lot of that is because of our concerns with intensification, or more precisely, rapid intensification. Anyone down south knows about Hurricane Charlie. We had a quick rapid intensification with Hurricane Charlie. And that's one of our biggest concerns, is having a weaker storm, let's say, just off the coast, maybe of Miami or Tampa or Sarasota, and overnight it develops in, from a Cat 2 to a Cat 4, something like Charlie did, into a major population area. So that's such a big concern. We're in the middle of a 10-year program trying to fix that. And this year is a big jump on trying to make that even better. So one of the things we're doing here at the Aircraft Operations Center is we're going with a little bit of a higher-speed satellite data feed, which for us high-speed isn't the same for someone sitting at home. We're still quite a ways behind when we have to transmit through the atmosphere up to the satellites and back. But we are going with a higher-speed satellite system in order to get more data off the aircraft, which is going to help the modelers at NOAA be able to look at better forecasting possibilities by being able to put more information into the models. We also have on the ground, on the other end of that, they have more and higher speed computers, which are able to crunch all the data that we'll be sending off the aircraft for better assimilation into the models. We also have some other things. We have instrumentation like what's called a Doppler wind LIDAR or a wide swath radar altimeter. I know that's kind of, again, those are geeky terms, we don't really want to get into too much
here. I'm loving it.
But it's wonderful instrumentation that we're going to be able to use in real time to get more information to the people who need it, which really filters down to the public.
I guess as a public person here, and I live on the water, there's several pieces of information I'd like. Sort of one is, what is this season going to look like in terms of how can you predict the number of hurricanes per season, and then sort of what's the path of a particular hurricane? How accurately can you tell where is this thing going? And then the other issue which you brought up, which I never even thought of, is you have a weak storm and then it rapidly intensifies. All right, so can you address those? How many hurricanes per season, the prediction, and then also where it goes and how you figure that stuff out?
It's actually very interesting. It can be very complicated, but it's very interesting the way they do the forecast. You may have heard of something called the butterfly effect. A lot of the forecasting goes into that. We take a look and we say, well, what parameters are setting up this year? And we may look even 3 to 6 months ago.
All right, so tell people what the butterfly effect is. I know what it is, but just briefly, just explain that.
Okay, the butterfly effect is that a small change or a small parameter somewhere down the line will have an effect on a larger parameter that may affect you. I guess that's for us.
A butterfly flaps its wing and a building falls over.
Correct, or a thunderstorm. Right? Yeah, a butterfly flaps its wing in St. Louis and a thunderstorm forms in Tampa, something along those lines.
There you go.
And what we're looking at is obviously something that's been big in the news this year is La Nina or El Nino or neutral or sort of a change between going from in this case where we have a La Nina going into neutral right now. So we look at those. We look at what kind of a thunderstorm season that they're having in northern Africa. We look at several parameters that happen out in Asia. And what happens is we try to see maybe even where the Atlantic high seems to be setting up. So we look at all these different parameters and say, okay, this is where it is right now. Where was this around this time in past hurricane season? And so what we start to do, or what our forecasters do, they start looking at all these different parameters, and that's why when they give numbers like this year where they're saying we should have 12 to 18 named storms, well, I mean, if you figure 12 to 18, that's a pretty good range, but that's the range of, if you look at most of the hurricane seasons that fell under most of the parameters we're seeing right now, they have had between 12 to 18 named storms. So that's how they make the forecast. It isn't like a 12-hour forecast where you're looking at where a storm is now and you're saying, I think it will be here in 12 hours. It's a completely different type of forecast.
Well, Paul, let me just interrupt you for a minute to be a little bit more specific. I am really interested in knowing what pulls a hurricane into the Gulf. Last year, as I understood it, we had wind shear that sort of protected the Gulf. That's gone now this year. So what are the optimal conditions for taking it out of the Atlantic and into the Gulf?
The big thing we want to focus on is the Atlantic, or what we call the Bermuda High. It's really where that sits. If you can imagine that big, massive high-pressure system sitting off the East Coast, if that shifts south, then we're going to have storms hang a little further south. If it shifts eastward, we tend to have the storms head up towards Bermuda. If it shifts westward, then we're going to start pushing everything into the Gulf. And so what we've seen, I think it was maybe 2-3 years ago, the Atlantic High was much further south and west than normal. So all of our storms were staying south of Cuba and heading into Central America. Well, if that high pressure shifts a little bit further north, that allows the general track to head right up into the Gulf or into Florida, which is what we saw in 2004-2005. Now, granted, the high-pressure system doesn't sit in one place the entire season. It's wobbling out there. So we can really only look at what we believe the forecast average is going to be. So where should that high pressure be sitting up? What's our forecast for that? And if we see, wow, it looks like it's going to be a little bit further west than normal, that isn't really a good sign for the Gulf of Mexico. So we kind of hope it moves further east, because that's when we see everything go up the East Coast and off to, say, out. We don't want it to hit Bermuda, obviously, but out in that direction.
All right, let's talk a little bit about NOAA itself and its role in terms of the big picture, because we have lots of agencies that get involved with hurricanes in terms of predictions and warnings and the police and laws, etc. So tell me a little bit about NOAA's role, and also how you interact with some other agencies.
Okay, yeah, we act with a lot of other agencies. We do some work with NASA, obviously. They've been getting into the hurricane business in the last few years, and other organizations such as NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. But we are the primary organization when it comes to everything that maybe when you watch the news and there's a storm out there, right from the beginning, the first thing you might hear when the storm is far off from land is what we're seeing on satellite. Okay, well, that's going to be NOAA satellites that are out there looking down, the infrared satellite imagery that we're going to use at our hurricane specialists that are at the NOAA National Hurricane Center will be making those forecasts, and they're the ones getting the information back to the people, to the folks, the emergency managers and government officials that will then pass the word on to the public. So we are really the primary agency from the satellite to the aircraft to those hurricane forecasts in real time. But we do work with the Air Force Reserve, for example. When we're out there flying hurricanes, the Air Force Reserve, they're out there flying the hurricanes as well. Slightly different mission, but we work together with them, and we do very good work with them as well. So they're another organization that's out there working with us. But when it really comes down to it, NOAA is that initially is that primary organization that's going to be the eyes for letting your emergency managers know what could be heading their way.
All right, so let's follow this along. Is the satellite says something's cooking out there? Oh, maybe we want to fly up in the airplane. What do you think, Paul? Should we take the airplane, the WSLR airplane, up in the storm?
Sure, anytime you want.
All right, let's take off. All right, let's take off and head up into a hurricane. And you've done this a time or two, correct?
Actually, I should be getting my 100th, I would expect with the forecast, my 100th hurricane penetration this summer. I'm at 97 right now.
Well, all right, so let's just warn our listeners. Please fasten your seatbelts. Hold on to your seats. This is going to be a rough ride, guaranteed. Okay, Paul, take us up.
All right. Well, we have some information. Satellites are great, but they can't tell us exactly what's going on. So we are en route to the storm. What I'm going to be doing as the meteorologist, as the flight director on the aircraft, I'm taking a look at what the Hurricane Center thinks is happening. I'm looking to see if the storm's moved over any buoys, if it's near any of the islands. Sometimes we can get some information from that as well. If it is near the islands, we can also get some radar imagery. Sometimes we may be flying for 2 hours before we get to the storm, so things can change while we're out there flying. The storm may intensify or even weaken. And as we mentioned, it might even rapidly intensify. So we're looking at all those things we can. So we're looking at satellite. We're looking at radar, if it's available. We're looking at observations, if they're available, including sometimes ships. You'll be surprised how many times a ship gets caught up in these storms. So we're gathering that information. Eventually, it gets close enough that we can actually see the storm on our radar. Usually, just through experience, we can take a look at it and say, hey, this looks pretty strong, or it looks as what we expected, or it might even look a little weaker than we expected. At that point, as a flight meteorologist or a flight director, I need to balance what our mission is, what are we trying to accomplish out there, versus the safety with what I'm seeing. If I'm expecting a Category 3 storm and we get out there and I see this thing looks like a Category 5, or if I see it has sort of a pentagon shape, or see little features in the radar that make me think I don't like the way that looks, I may ask the pilots to go ahead and climb a couple of thousand feet, get us a little more distance from the water. We may fly through it one or two times before we say, okay, you know what, the storm isn't as bad as we thought. Let's go ahead and we'll lower our altitude. So at this point, all that stuff's going through my head. I'm also making observations that I'm sending to the National Hurricane Center, because they don't only want to know where exactly the storm center is and how strong the winds are in the eyewall. They want to know how far out the 35-knot winds are going. They want to know how quickly those winds are changing, how far out the rain bands are going. So I'm making observations all the way out there. So we are basically in business from the time we hit the water off the coast until we come back home. So things get busy pretty quickly, and so that's what's going through our minds. We're buckled in.
We're buckled in here too.
Yeah, we're buckled in, and now we're about, you know, probably 2 minutes outside from the eye wall, so it starts getting dark. At that point, especially on a strong storm, we're committed. And by
so
that,
you're going from bright daylight, now it's getting dark, huh?
Oh, yeah, it happens. Going in isn't so bad, because it happens slowly. But coming out, you go from bright skies to that wall of clouds in front of you, and that's always fun when you have a new pilot on board. Because the first time you're telling them, okay, go straight that way, and they're looking at a wall, and it's kind of like, wow, that's what we're about to fly through. So that's always a fun realization for them.
And the winds pick up suddenly, right? So we should hold on as and turn on the lights, I guess, because it's going to get dark, right?
Absolutely. Going in, they increase a little bit more moderately. You know, we get the rain bands and things start speeding up, and then they speed up. The winds will pick up a little more rapidly when we hit the eye wall. But the real thing you'll notice most is the rain, because the aircraft just starts getting pummeled with the rain, and you can't see anything regardless of light because of the rain that's out there. And then once we, like I mentioned, we're committed, because we don't want to make turns in the eye wall. We want to be perfectly perpendicular going through that eye wall with a slight sort of upstream tilt, so we don't lose our angle that we're trying to enter the storm. So that's sort of committed before we hit the eye wall. And once we're in, we just hold on, because we have to get through it at that point. There's nothing we can do until you get up the other side. And then all of a sudden, especially on a well-developed storm, it just brightens up like someone turned the light on. The clouds clear, you look up, you see blue skies, you're surrounded by an eye wall, and you look down, and you don't always get to see the ocean water. You'd be surprised. A lot of people think because the eye is clear, you can see the water, but that's not the case, because there's so much warm, humid air down there. There's usually a layer of of clouds, very low clouds. But right around the eye wall, as the flight meteorologist, as soon as we break through, I'm looking down and back so I can get a visual on what the water looks like and what the waves look like, so I can report that as part of my observation.
All right. How about the size of the eye? How does that figure in?
We like larger eyes for what we're doing. If anything does happen when we go through the eye wall, and sometimes it does, because we don't always take big hits, but it does happen occasionally. We want to be able to fly around the eye, inside the eye, and fix it. So, and then continue on with our mission. So if we have a 40-mile wide eye, for example, when Katrina was a large eye and Hurricane Isabel was a large eye, for example, we can fly around as long as we want. There's so much room in there, it's like you're in a humongous stadium because the clouds give you a stadium effect, the way they kind of slant further outward as you go up in altitude. So we can fly around for a while, get everything set back up, and then we'll jump back in our seats and we'll head back out. There was a storm I flew a couple of years ago south of Jamaica, which was the name's slipping me now, but it was one of those rapid intensifiers, and the plane that went through just before us took a 4G hit, which meant we'll just say it was
four times gravity.
Yes, and so it was enough that they had to terminate the mission immediately, and so we were the next aircraft going in, and so right there wasn't a really good feeling, and as we got closer, I was looking at the eye, and I was having a hard time pulling it up on my radar until we got really close, and I realized we have about an 8-mile wide eye, and traveling at 4 miles a minute, that means you only have 2 minutes from one eyewall to the next, and I have to try to find the center and make an observation. So I just told the pilots, when we get in the eye, I'm only giving you one heading change, and then that's it. We're heading back out. We don't have time to do anything else. So so if something were to go wrong through the eyewall, we don't have enough room to fly around and try to take care of business. So we feel a little more comfortable when the eyes are larger.
All right, Paul, that was very exciting. We are out of time, so okay. We're going to have to move. Thank you so much for bringing this up. And you said for this hurricane season, you're saying what about, did you say 12 to 18 storms? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the NOAA forecasters have come out with 12 to 18. And your other guest mentioned earlier about the shear. I think that one of the biggest messages that I could pass out to people locally here is, we don't make forecasts for where storms may go, but some of the setups that I've seen this year so far have been similar to what we saw in 2004 and 2005. I haven't looked at much at where the high pressure is expected to set up, but I would just make sure your listeners know it doesn't matter if there's only three storms through the year. If one of them hits us, it's a bad year, so be prepared.
Thank you so much, Paul Flaherty from NOAA, for joining us. You're the best.
All right, thank you, sir. We'll talk to you later.
I just love talking to you. Just going up in that plane.
What an exciting job. I mean, you know, 7 minutes. So I wonder sometimes.
And people's lives at risk here, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And the amount of information that he's processing, he's like a computer under a tight time frame. It's
and he told
amazing.
Me last time that we spoke, he's in contact over time with the scientists who then set him up with observations and experiments to do so that when he gets there, and I mean, he said he had time for like one quick observation.
Right.
So he's got to be all ready. All right, boom, you're in the eye. Do it all. Do it all now and get this information. So that the scientists, and then the next time he goes up, the scientists will give him slightly different instructions and modify, and they're constantly modifying their different predictors, the programs that they use. All right, let's get a Media we'll get our Tannen Weekly. We also have Media Matters Minute. Let's get this one going. This should be good.
Committee wants sex off the table. Washington, D.C., special to the Tannen Weekly. A bipartisan congressional committee today issued a plea for presidential hopefuls of both parties to reveal their complete sex lives from puberty to the present time. According to the committee's chair, this plan will let the voters move past the usual campaign sex exposés and allow them to focus on the candidates' qualifications. "We waste too much time talking about lurid sex scandals," he said. "Let's make everything public right now. Let the media have their feeding frenzy for a few weeks. Then we can get serious about picking our next president." The chairman made this unusual plea because not enough committee members were present for a quorum to pass the legislation. One member from Delaware was recently put in jail for exposing himself to an underage girl in the Washington subway. Another was being held in Kansas for using his Twitter account to forward pornography to senior citizens. A third was being investigated for making lewd remarks to a waitress in a topless bar in Nevada. Neither major political party was available for comment.
The Tannen Weekly is distributed by WSLRLP, FM 96.5, a Pacifica affiliate in Sarasota, Florida, and recorded at Mountaintop Studios in New York City.
And thanks to Pete Tannen for supplying us with that audio every week. And Pete Tannen is an award-winning writer. He lives here locally in Sarasota. You can get his columns at TannenWeekly.com. He comes out with those just about every week, and we appreciate that. All right, let's switch gears, and we're going to go back to the weather now. And good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
And my name is Steve. Our co-host is Andrea. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, Surreal News Show. Andrea is going to introduce you.
Good morning, Ed, and thanks for coming on. We're back down to earth now. We've just been flying in the center of a hurricane, and now we're hoping that you're going to tell us a little bit about, you know, predictions and how to prepare once it's suspected that a hurricane's coming our way. You are the Director of Emergency Management for Sarasota.
And
we'd like to, you know, start by asking you a little bit about evacuation and what the evacuation stipulations are for Sarasota and all the Keys.
Well, being a coastal community so close to the Gulf of Mexico, we have the threat of storm surge from a hurricane. That's one of the threats that a hurricane poses, in addition to the hurricane force winds, the flooding, rains, and the tornadoes. But being a coastal community, we have that additional threat of that storm tide that can come inland many miles. So in order to determine the evacuation areas, what we do is the regional planning councils for the state of Florida, which are our 11 regions, work very closely with NOAA and with the National Hurricane Center, and they develop the storm surge inundation zones based on running a computer model of hurricanes towards the coastline multiple times. Then they paint, for lack of a better term, the colors for the Category 1 through 5 hurricane threat onto that map. And then we, as emergency managers, look at those areas and fill them in and create the evacuation zones. So when a hurricane is threatening, if they tell us that there's a particular height of storm surge and type of hurricane coming, we know what areas are the most vulnerable, and we begin the evacuation process. For the wind threat, which can threaten mobile homes and weaker structures, we evacuate those areas as well.
All right, so that gives us an idea of how you're predicting the most vulnerable areas, is that correct?
Yes. The vulnerable areas for storm surge are predicted by utilizing these computer models. It's a process called SLOSH, Sea Lake Overland Surge from Hurricane. And it's basically running a simulated hurricane towards the coastline and then predicting how far that water would go inland based on the terrain and the elevation of the ground from sea level moving inland.
And just a follow-up, since we just had NOAA on, so would you then take the information NOAA would give you about essentially the strength of the hurricane and say where it might have landfall, and then take that forward with your computer program? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, and we use those models and those maps to determine what areas need to be evacuated. There's a maximum surge height that correlates with each of the five zones. You have zone A through E corresponding to each levels of those hurricanes. Now, the barrier islands on the coast are a little different. The storm surge models may show that there's high ground on those islands, but we just consider all of the barrier islands as a zone A, regardless of their elevation, because the isolation issues. If storm surge impacts an island and takes out the bridge, for instance, people cannot get off or on, and we can't get help out there. So for the sake of safety, we evacuate all of the barrier islands as a zone A, and the areas immediately hitting the intercoastal or the inland areas as well.
Well, Ed, I've got a question about evacuation, and I may be wrong on this, but I understand that now evacuation is going to begin to occur 3 days, you know, prior to a storm in order to ensure that people get off and we don't have the kind of situation that happened outside of New Orleans where, you know, there's just such massive traffic jams. People are sitting on the roads when the storm comes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Have there been changes?
Well, I think every storm provides a different challenge and a different set of protective measures. If we had pretty good knowledge from the Hurricane Center that a Category 5 storm was coming, and it was going to inundate our entire coastline, then we would have to begin 72 hours out to begin that process. We would probably have to begin moving people away from the most vulnerable areas sooner. That presents a challenge because sometimes the storm takes a different track, and then people feel that you acted, you know, overreacted, so to speak. So it is a challenge for emergency managers. But what you'll see us doing is, based on the threat and the information we're given from the Hurricane Center, we'll begin making those recommendations early, and we'll be moving people out of the most vulnerable areas first in sort of a phased approach. In other words, moving the people off the barrier islands first, then those in the low-lying areas and closer to the coast, and then moving inland, giving people an opportunity to get out. It's sort of like what they have to do in the Florida Keys. Every time a storm comes that's going to threaten the Florida Keys, they evacuate the lower Keys. Then in several hours later, they evacuate the center Keys and then the upper Keys.
So this sounds like you're kind of walking a tightrope in terms of your credibility. If you predict something and then you evacuate and it doesn't, you know, turn out to actually happen, what kind of liability do you have? Let's say, you know, a business has to close down for 5 days and no storm hits. And, you know, I guess over time people would become sort of non-compliant if you make predictions that don't come true. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, we can only utilize the information that we're given from the Hurricane Center, the computer models, the radar. But, you know, when it comes to life safety, we have to make those recommendations that make sense. We're very cautious. I'll give you an example was Hurricane Wilma. You know, that was the very first storm that I dealt with in Sarasota County. It was actually already threatening when I took over on October 21st of 05. And the first question I was asked my first day was, what's your recommendation? And the storm track appeared to be south of us. So I wasn't real concerned about a direct hit, but we were going to see some residual impacts. So I recommended a voluntary evacuation for all. And we talked about it in the public safety leadership, talked about it, and we increased that to a mandatory mobile home because we were worried about the impact from the wind in the mobile homes, especially in the southern part of the county in Inglewood and Venice. So it became a voluntary with a mandatory mobile home. We opened shelters, and that's exactly what we got. We got some pretty good winds. Some rooftops came off of mobile homes, and we did that right. For Tropical Storm Fay, which could have been a Category 1, we did a voluntary and a mandatory mobile home, and we advised all the citizens in the Level A zones, especially on the island, be prepared just in case. So we watch it very closely. We know we don't just make quick decisions on who's going to evacuate, but if there is a potential threat, we have to take those actions to save lives. I would rather be wrong and a storm not come than to take a chance and then the storm ends up coming and killing people. So I think there's more liability in underreacting than there is in overreacting.
All right, we're listening to Ed McRain. And he is with the emergency management here in Sarasota, correct, with the government? Yes, am I saying that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
So you said in 05 when you came on, you immediately had to make a decision. I imagine that was a little bit stressful, but I guess that's part of your job. So tell us a little bit about your preparation personally for this role, this important role that you have in the community, and generally what type of preparation, if somebody was interested in pursuing this, one would need to do the job that you do?
Well, everyone comes to the emergency management field from a different background. Emergency management is now starting, you know, the most recent 5 years or so to becoming a field of its own, where people are actually going to take courses on emergency management and homeland security and being educated in those processes. In the past, in my upbringing, people came out of other public safety agencies, maybe military, law enforcement, or fire. I served 22 years in the United States Army, and I specialized in combat operations, but also operations, intelligence, and planning, and logistics. So when I retired from the military, I began working with the state of Florida as a regional coordinator for the Tampa Bay area, and worked with the seven counties surrounding Tampa Bay, responding to them as a state liaison and providing them resources for the hurricanes and disasters. And I was able to actually participate in the 9 hurricanes in the 04 and 05 season and gained a lot of experience on how things were done poorly and how things were done well. And then I brought basically that experience and background to this job. But it's just a matter, I think that the key to being an emergency manager is to, first of all, understand the process of emergency planning and coordination, understanding how you get other people to work together. That the challenge that we have is we don't really own, as the government, all the resources that we need to respond. But there are private sector, public sector, private nonprofit agencies, faith-based groups within the community. And that if we share our resources and we work closely together, we can accomplish the things that we need to do. And then beyond that, we request state and federal assistance to come in when appropriate.
We were talking about hurricanes because that's on people's minds right now, hurricanes, floods, and those kinds of things. Could you give us an insight into some of the other things that you would need to emergency manage?
Well, last year, this time, we were dealing with an oil spill threat. The year prior to that, we dealt with the H1N1 flu pandemic. So just about anything, we classify them as technological, natural, and man-made disasters. Some terrorism is always a possibility. A lot of people think that threat is over because Osama bin Laden has been killed. Well, yesterday it was announced that his successor has been named, and there are continued threats out there. So although Sarasota County and our area is probably a low-level threat, places like New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, maybe even Tampa Bay have a higher level of threat for that. We have severe weather hazards. So right now we're in a major drought. There are over 400 fires burning in the state of Florida alone right now. So there are multiple threats that people need to be prepared for. But hurricane season, lasts from June 1st to November 30th, and it presents probably the highest potential for major impact to the majority of our population because we live so close to the coastline.
I've often heard, Ed, that hurricanes tend to hit, Florida and this region of Florida, this coast, later in the year, August, September. Is that true or is that just a wise tale?
No, it's true to a certain extent. I mean, a hurricane can hit any time of the season, but for the most part, this time of year, the hurricanes have a tendency of developing within the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean and heading pretty much to the northwest. But in September-October time frame, they tend to form in the Caribbean or in the Gulf of Mexico, and those winter troughs and cold fronts that seem to come in across the United States tend to turn those storms into the Gulf, and that's when Florida's west coast has the highest potential of being hit. Looking back historically, there were a lot of hurricanes that hit Florida in the 20s and in the 40s, and then we experienced a period of quiet through the late 60s through the 90s. Then Andrew hit in 92, and since then we've been in what they call a higher level in a multi-decadal cycle, which we're probably going to be in for about another 10 to 15 years. So you're going to see increased hurricane activity for about another 10, 15 years. This year they're predicting 16 storms, 9 of them becoming hurricanes, and 5 major. Whether or not we get them or not, it stands to be seen. And I try to take these one at a time and monitor them as they pose a threat to us.
And it's interesting, and you mentioned the cycles with hurricanes, and on this show we talk about some controversial issues like, global warming and intensification of storms and such like that. Without getting too controversial here, because I don't want to put you on the spot, I know you work for the government, etc. Does climate change and intensification of storms, is that something that you figure into your emergency management preparation?
Well, it's always a consideration, and it's always possible that some aspects of climate change affect the severity of certain storms. I take them one at a time, regardless of what's causing them to be more intense or less intense. What threat do they pose to us, and how can we best respond to it is the way we approach it. But like I said, if you look back over history, I actually have some slides that I show when I do public presentations that goes back to the 1920s and shows those hurricane tracks. And you can see where in the 20s and especially in the 40s, Florida was inundated with storms. And then we had those periods of quiet, which were disrupted in the late 90s as well. So you could argue that was climate change a factor in the 20s and the 40s, or was this just this multi-decadal cycle they talk about? But, you know, we live on a planet that is a living, for lack of a better term, a living, breathing, entity, and we can't control what it does, from volcanoes to earthquakes to tsunamis. I think that those are naturally occurring things that the Earth does to cool itself, and it has a natural process. The disaster is not those things. The disaster is that we choose to live in these vulnerable areas in the path of these things. And, we love it, we call it the price for living in paradise. You know, if I could afford it, I would have a house right on the beach, yeah, overlooking the beautiful Gulf of Mexico. But I would know that those threats are there. And when the time came, I would have to have a place to go until the threat was over.
Let's talk about shelters, because that's part of the plan, right?
Yes, sir.
So you get involved with setting up and the issues with shelters, is that correct?
Yes, we work with our school district and the American Red Cross. All of the public schools that are in the safe areas, outside of the Category 3 evacuation zone, have to be built by state law. To 50% of the campus has to be built to the enhanced hurricane protection standard. And I have to grant an exemption to the school if the school is in a Category 3, 1, 2, or 3 zone, A, B, or C. They don't have to build it to that code. But if it's outside of that area, they do. We utilize those facilities to shelter people. We try to tell people that they're there, but they are a measure of last resort. We ask people to try to make arrangements with friends and family in safe structures, or you go to other locations. But the shelters are there for those that need them. We can provide up to 20 shelters depending on the threat that's being imposed on us.
Ed, I just want to back up a little bit and, throw out another one of possibly my misconceptions or a wise tale. People say that Sarasota is very difficult to hit because a hurricane would have to come into the Gulf and then take a sharp right. And the last time we were hit directly, I think, was in the 50s when we blew out Midnight Pass. Is that true? And is that notion that Sarasota is sort of protected by our location valid?
Well, I've heard that, and I've also heard about the Indian spirits that are, protect us, and nobody hopes that stuff is true more than I do. But we can't really count on that. And really, the worst-case scenario for us is not a direct hit on Sarasota. It's a direct hit on Tampa Bay.
Right.
A major storm that strikes Tampa Bay would cause the worst-case scenario storm surge for both us and Manatee County.
Right.
Longboat Key, Siesta Key, Manta Maria, all those places would be totally inundated from the storm surge.
Mm-hmm.
It does take a lot for a storm to turn, but if you look at historical data from the 20s and the 40s, we had the 1921 hurricane came in just north of Manatee County into, Tarpon Springs, and that totally change the face of Gulfstream Boulevard in Sarasota.
Right,
there used to be fishing piers there, and they were totally destroyed.
So if you're south of the direct hit, you're likely to take a lot of storm surge?
Yes.
Yeah.
If you look at the storm's approach, we call it the upper right quadrant. So if it's a west to east strike, then south of it would be the worst. If
mm-hmm.
it goes directly north into the panhandle, then the east side or the right side of the storm is the worst. Consider that counterclockwise circulation of the storm building up water under the radius of maximum winds and pushing it towards the shoreline. So that's where you're going to see the more intense storms, and then it's where you're going to see the tornadoes in the outer bands as well.
Well, Ed, this has really been informative, but we have to move on. It's towards the end of the program.
And just before we let you go, is there a website if people want to get more information from the government?
Yes, thank you for asking. www.scgov.net, scgov.net. And on there at the very bottom, there's a button that says All Hazards Be Prepared. If people click on that, it will take them to the emergency management website. And there are many buttons on there. One of them that I want everybody to look at is called Find Your Evacuation Zone. When you click on that, you can put in your street address, select your zip code, and it will tell you whether your home or business is within an A, B, C, D, or E zone, or out of the evacuation areas.
All right, fabulous. We certainly appreciate that, and WSLR certainly is available here. We're the local radio station here, and you're certainly welcome to get in touch with us if you'd like announcements locally. Put on the radio. We're certainly here to help as part of this community. Thank you so much, Ed.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address your audience. Take care.
All right. He was very articulate and helpful. That was, and I liked it. Interesting, his background, sort of logistics in the Army. Yeah, he can move some people.
Right. Coordination between the private and the public sector, it's important. Hey, I just want to remind everybody that this hour of Surreal News has been brought to you by NewView. It's a local business specializing in managing and caring for your home. From property management to house cleaning to window cleaning, NewView has served Sarasota residents for 15 years. For more information, contact NewView at 955-4060. Thanks.
All right, very good. And the opinions here are not those of WSLR. It's board members, volunteers, employees, or anyone else, just to the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. We have just a limited amount of time and some news and some media matters to report. Let's start with a quick media matters, and then we have complex waveforms coming up next.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Danny Herrera. Conservative media figures are pushing a study on sunspots in a desperate attempt to dismiss scientific consensus on global warming.
Guess what? The Earth is facing a mini ice age within 10 years due to a rare drop in sunspot activity. And yet Al Gore has just endorsed Mitt Romney. Well, endorsed him, but he's praised Mitt Romney for his stance on man-made global warming.
And now all of a sudden we have reports suggesting it's not going to be global warming. Now we're going back to global cooling again.
When we contacted one of the researchers of the study for clarification, solar physicist Frank Hill replied, quote, "We are not predicting a mini ice age. We are predicting the behavior of the solar cycle. In my opinion, it is a huge leap from that to an abrupt global cooling." For these stories and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
All right, that's our Media Matters Minute. Actually, we have others, but we're not going to have time to get to them today because we're coming to the end of a show here. And I just want to mention, I do have a few other late-breaking news items. Rick Scott is retreating on worker drug testing. This is late-breaking news. Governor Rick Scott suspended the order requiring state workers to undergo drug testing. Also in national news, Russ Feingold, the Democratic Party is in danger of losing its identity. And this is because the Democratic Party, according to Feingold, is taking too much money from corporations. And he has some comments about that. We're not going to have time to get to that today. Also in the story, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was arrested for indecent acts when he's running for president of France, it was reported in the news late yesterday that when he was arrested, he claimed diplomatic immunity. Late-breaking news. Some other news items we're not going to get to today. Juan Cole targeted by Bush House for Iraq war skepticism, according to a former CIA agent. Also in the news, the House votes to block FDA approval of genetically modified salmon. We're not going to have time to get to that. Also in the news, China's cyber war strength must be boosted to counter Pentagon threat. A little twist there, according to a top military newspaper. And this item, infant formula linked to juvenile diabetes. And this has to do with highly hydrolyzed infant formulas have a less risk of developing diabetes for the kids. Well, we're not going to have time to get to other news items today because we're coming to the end of the show. We have complex waveforms coming up. Thank you so much for tuning in to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station.
and complex waveforms is coming up next. Be sure to listen to our local news show, which is The Jumping Mullet, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 6 to 6:30. And Andrea was on this Wednesday and sounded excellent with Joan and with, who else did you have on there?
Nancy.
Nancy and...
we had a... Gee, I don't remember his. He was great, though, and it was a great show, and it's also a good way to practice.
So that's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you don't want to miss that. And we have Democracy Now! From 5 to 6 before that. It's going to be a hot day today with about a 30% chance of showers. Hurricanes, about 16 this season, 16 to the 18, according to Noah, who was on earlier. And we really want to thank Paul. I think he's a great guest. It's so interesting.
Let's wait until September and start worrying about it, right? Oh, brother.
All right, we're going to break into this music now and start Complex Waveforms featuring Mark. A great show. Coming up next, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station.